Multiple children have died in Gaza as a result of starvation, dehydration. 15,000 babies and children in Gaza killed in the last 5 months, which now exceeds the number of all children which have been killed as a result of conflict worldwide in the last 4 years. The extensive use of torture against Palestinians taken prisoner by the Israeli military in Gaza, including 21 UNRWA staff members.
They're torturing people who work for the UN. Can you imagine what they're doing to Palestinians?
Let's get into some of the specifics. Practices recorded by UNRWA include the use of a nail gun on prisoners' knees, sexual abuse against both men and women, and the insertion of what appears to be an electrified metal stick into Palestinian prisoners' rectums. They were beating me with an extendable metal bar. There was blood on my trousers, and when they saw it, they beat me there. Day 161 of the Gaza genocide. And it's like the situation continues to turn into more and more of a caricature of itself. Like, you have Matthew Miller announce that the U.S. has just sanctioned another three whole settlers, right? They held a press conference all about it. There was a big announcement. That comes on top of the four whole settlers that were sanctioned weeks ago when this whole distraction tactic was first unveiled. And it really is an illustration of just how horrific the U.S. policy is. We're 161 days into the genocide, and the U.S. policy is exactly where it was on day one. No red lines for Israel. They've said that verbatim time and time again. They don't interrupt the transfer of weapons. They haven't interrupted the funding. They haven't interrupted the diplomatic protection or the verbal assurances that they are 100% behind Israel. But every once in a while, they'll come out with one of these moves, like sanctioning a settler, as a gesture intended to show, no, look, we're actually a fair broker here. We're a neutral party. We're, you know, whatever it is that this move is intended to do, to position themselves as not exactly always in agreement with Israel on every single thing that Israel does. But of course, we know it's completely theatrical. It's completely irrelevant, and it doesn't address any of the underlying issues. If the U.S. was really interested in applying sanctions against settlers and settlements in a way that actually respected international law, they would have to apply sanctions on all 700,000 settlers in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem. And they would have to order the dismantlement of every single settlement on that land. That's the solution that's consistent with international law. Notice how far we are from that solution, from the U.S. espousing that position. They literally have 699,993 settlers to go.
I gotta say, I'm not one of those Jews that's good at math, but it seems like it could go quicker. I mean, at this rate.
Yeah, when do we get to all the settlers? When do you finish sanctioning everybody? If you're going at a rate of like seven, you know, in 5 months. So I just want us to be aware of that. I want us to be aware of the things which are intended to distract us in this moment, like the airdrops, these humiliating, fatal, illusory, ineffective so-called airdrops, right? That multiple states are actually engaged in. Egypt, the US, Germany, Jordan, multiple states are actually participating in parachuting in boxes of aid. I saw a Palestinian open one of these boxes, which he managed to retrieve from the northern part of Gaza, and he showed what was in it. It was literally like food for soldiers, like freeze-dried, ready-to-eat calories, right? It was like freeze-dried applesauce or something, and peanut butter packets. Like, I'm sorry, how are you going to feed a starving family, including toddlers, on peanut butter packets and, you know, applesauce? It just doesn't make sense. And crackers, dry crackers, was also in the box.
And also the aid drop killed some people. Like,
yes,
the
fatal
parachute malfunctioned and murdered some people, landed on them.
Including children. Children were also killed during one of these malfunctioning aid drops. And so this continues to happen. We're seeing these, you know, so-called aid drops taking place on a near daily basis now. Nowhere near the, you know, meeting, nowhere near the amount of actual need that is present in Gaza. It's just for show.
I had no idea that all of these countries had theatrical backgrounds.
Yeah.
These countries are engaging in such a clear form of theater. Obviously, the best way to get aid would be to go through the ground, right? Would be to cross where there are aid trucks waiting outside. But you've got the fucking King of Jordan suiting up like he's a damn Navy SEAL, taking thirst trap photos. And it's like, you guys are actors? Why are we all acting like the easiest way to get food to Gazans is by dropping it like Operation Dumbo? You know what I mean? Why are we all pretending that the best way to get food to people who are starving is through the air and then with a parachute? I thought y'all didn't like parachutes. I thought that's what started this whole thing. Okay?
I'm not going to laugh.
Now they're pro-parachute. Okay? It's interesting. U.S. imperialism, not exactly known for culinary exemplary.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever been invaded by the United States, and it's helped the cuisine.
Hello, and welcome to episode 117 of the Palestine Pod, the weekly podcast where we break down the latest headlines dealing with Palestine from all over the world and bring you stories, commentary, and interviews with the aim of supporting the Palestinian struggle for decolonization, justice, and equal rights. I'm one of your hosts, Lara E. You might know me from Instagram as @GazanGirl, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mikey B.
What's up, y'all? Mikey B on TikTok. Michael Schertzer on Instagram, and you can call me Mikey Intifada if you took time away from torturing UN employees to call Palestinian protesters terrorists.
Before we get into today's episode, please like, comment, subscribe if you hang out with us on YouTube. If you're listening on a podcast app, subscribe and leave a review. As always, you can find our full episodes and sources on palestinepod.com. And if you want to get involved in the conversation, reach out to us at palestinepod@gmail.com and give us a follow on Instagram @thepalestinepod. Find us also on Patreon, where you get early access to the Palestine Pod episodes, an additional podcast called the Patreon Pod. It's a little more laid back. We talk politics, Palestine, pop culture, and get a little more personal. We're also hosting our monthly Zoom happy hours with our Patreon subscribers only. So check us out on patreon.com/PalestinePod. While this whole aid drop circus is happening, we know that 1 in 3 children under the age of 2 in northern Gaza is now acutely malnourished, according to UNRWA. Children's malnutrition is spreading fast and reaching unprecedented levels in Gaza, and there's no time to waste, UNRWA said in a statement published on Saturday, March 16th. Multiple children have died in Gaza as a result of malnutrition and dehydration in the last several days and weeks. It seems like every day I'm logging on to see the news of yet another child, yet another toddler, yet another young person dying of starvation, dying of dehydration. And this is all completely avoidable. This all doesn't have to happen. And remember, all of this is a result of Israel not allowing aid to enter Gaza. Israel is continuing to block the entrance of aid, turn around trucks, inspect trucks, and send them back. And it is doing so while it is telling the world that it's not the one that's blocking the aid. But the data speaks for itself, and you can go on OCHA's website, and you can see day by day how many aid trucks are entering Gaza. Compare that to what the situation was before October 7th. Compare it also to how many trucks were entering Gaza before the ICJ order on provisional measures, and then compare it to how many trucks have entered Gaza since the ICJ order on provisional measures. What you'll see is that Israel actually has allowed in less trucks since the ICJ's order on provisional measures than it did before the ICJ order on provisional measures. In both cases, whether before or after, the amount of trucks is nowhere near what is needed for people to survive in Gaza, because we know that pre-October 7th, an average of around 500 trucks were entering Gaza, and that amount in and of itself was already considered as putting Gazans on a starvation plus diet. That was the policy that Israel had adopted. They calculated the amount of calories that Palestinians in Gaza needed, and then they gave them just that amount in order to avoid starvation. That was the pre-October 7th policy. Since then, the amount of trucks has gone completely down and has only lessened since the ICJ order on provisional measures. And why do I keep referencing the ICJ order? Because in the order, it told Israel to allow in humanitarian aid in order to counter the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. And so this is now a direct violation of the ICJ order on provisional measures. The fact that not only has Israel not even maintained the amount of trucks that were coming in before the order, but it actually has continued to go down.
You think it's possible their lawyers are just so dumb they misinterpreted the order?
No, but I do think that they are intentionally manipulating what the order says. Actually, I know they are, because did you see that AIPAC document that was circulated, that was leaked?
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Sure did. It's my phone back screen now.
Leaked AIPAC talking points to Congress. Here's what it says. So apparently this is what AIPAC is telling Congress. So this is what Congress now knows to say whenever they're questioned about the question of humanitarian aid. These are the AIPAC talking points. If they're asked a question, why is Israel blocking the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza? The talking points are as follows. They say, you must say that Israel is not blocking aid. Israel has placed no limits on the amount of aid. Reports that people in Gaza are starving are false, and that Hamas is using starvation to exert pressure on Israel. And if the international community wants to send more aid, they have to just comply with security and logistics procedures. And to the extent aid is not reaching Gazan civilians, two subpoints, according to AIPAC, Hamas is stealing aid and to restock its fighters, and Hamas is stealing aid to sell on the black market. Every single one of these talking points is refuted by the OCHA data on the number of trucks that are entering Gaza. The number of trucks is lower than what it was before the ICJ order, and is drastically lower than what is needed to keep the population of Gaza alive.
You forgot the talking point articulated by Republican Representative Andy Ogles of Tennessee, who responded to an activist's question about the deaths of Palestinian children by saying we should kill them all.
Right.
I guess they left that one off the list.
We continue to see major dehumanization of Palestinians espoused by elected officials in the United States, as if a genocide wasn't happening against children, as if 15,000 babies and children in Gaza were not killed in the last 5 months. A number, by the way, which now exceeds the number of all children which have been killed as a result of conflict worldwide in the last 4 years. What we have seen in Gaza trumps what we have seen in the world for the last 4 years. And there are still people telling you that Israel must press on. The genocide must continue. It's going to be a very long road. Because I thought, maybe perhaps foolishly, that we could convince the world, you know, once we reached 5,000 children killed, 10,000 children killed, that this needed to stop. It seems that there is no number that will actually lead to like a collective awakening of those in power. Actually, I think they think we're all disposable and dispendable, and it doesn't really matter. We have to keep pushing much harder, much, much, much harder than we already are, because clearly our efforts have not yielded any sort of relief on the ground. All of this to say that this comes on the heels of just yesterday, Netanyahu approving plans for an attack on Rafah. Media is reporting on it as if it hasn't already been happening. It has already been happening. They've been attacking Rafah every day, every single day of this genocide. And so the way that it's spoken about as if Rafah is this safe place, when in fact that's not true, because every day I see family homes in Rafah that have been targeted and entire families that have been killed. That is unquestionable. Those videos, it's all out there. You can see it. Rafah has never been safe for anyone. But if this actual invasion takes place, where Rafah is invaded en masse, like a ground invasion, or is, you know, carpet bombed, what will happen to the 1.5 million Palestinians who are currently displaced there? Those who have been expelled from their homes, whose homes were destroyed in the north and in the central parts of Gaza, where are they supposed to go? What will happen to them? Is this the mass exodus now that's going to take place to Egypt? Is that what this moment is? I don't know. We have yet to see what it will actually look like, but it's absolutely insane. Absolutely insane. Palestinians have been pushed into Rafah on the premise that it was safe. It was never safe for one day. And not only that, but now it is going to be attacked in a way that we have not seen. And what can we do?
You know, I see a lot of people who are dealing with a lack of direction. They are feeling hopeless in their jobs. They are scrolling mindlessly. They are consuming media and food that has no nutritional value. They are spending their life giving their labor to somebody who doesn't respect them. They are working so hard to pay for an apartment they'll never own. And the only way you'll find meaning in this existence is if you commit your life entirely to the liberation of Palestine. And I say that as somebody who came from where they are. I used to just watch food videos. I used to do all of these things. And working towards the liberation of Palestine has changed my life and turned me into the person who I want to be and brought me to community with people who I want to be in community with. And so if we can all collectively commit to that, we can save Palestine and we can save ourselves from this vapid existence. And it's the only way. The only way is to commit yourself fully to the cause of justice, to the decolonization of Palestine, the right of return for the refugees, and the complete dissolution of the settler colony. And that will set many people free.
While you were speaking, I just saw that 36 people have been killed in an Israeli airstrike on Nusayrat refugee camp. Most were children. I feel like one of the phenomenon that's happened as this genocide has gone on is that we are speaking less and less about the individual attacks and the individual people who have been affected, and more like from a perspective of analysis and commentary, but not so much about what specifically is happening. So I'd like to just give some of the updates of the last few days to give space for those people who are being injured and killed in this moment. Just since the beginning of March, let's look at the beginning of March. Between March 1st and March 4th, Israel killed 306 Palestinians. Between March 4th and 5th, Israel killed 97 Palestinians. Between March 5th and 6th, Israel killed 86 Palestinians. Between March 6th and 7th, Israel killed 83 Palestinians. Between March 7th and 8th, Israel killed 78 Palestinians. Between March 8th to the 11th, Israel killed 234 Palestinians. And since March 11th, Israel has killed over 150 Palestinians. There is now I don't even know what to call it, a daily number, like a daily average number of Palestinians being killed that is not eliciting the outrage that it should. And it's like somewhere between 60 to 80 to 100 to 150. Is it that the days that they killed 700 in the earlier parts of the genocide shocked us so much that now when they're killing about 100 Palestinians per day, it's sort of like numbed us and we're not really able to realize that this is still extremely tragic and not normal? I don't know what it is, but there's this like sense that the outrage is not matching the reality. And the reality has never been worse on the ground by all metrics, across the board, for all the things that are needed to sustain life, you know, food and water and cleanliness and housing and access to medical care and all of these things. It has never been worse. But the outrage is just not matching the reality.
Some people are losing steam because the genocide has been going on for so long and they went through a full shock cycle of, oh my God, this thing is terrible. I need to do something about it. Let me get involved. Then they realized it's like it takes more than just going to a protest, and some of them have lost energy. And it's true, some of the protests have been waning in numbers, but some of them have been vibrant. Some of the messengers of the diaspora have been cut off in social media, right? Like, for instance, Nurdine Kiswani had her account taken completely off the internet. Wohl, within our lifetime, also had their account swept off the internet. And this was done likely at a high level at Meta. From every angle, the machine is trying to silence us. The machine is trying to slow down the momentum. The machine is trying to go back to a place where we felt isolated, where we felt alone. Because there was a brief moment where it felt like we had community with the whole world. And that's why you're seeing the introduction of a bill that forces the sale of TikTok to an American company, or else they'll ban it, because they want to exert the same type of control and censorship that you're seeing with platforms like Meta. They want to be able to disappear Nurdine Kiswani online, and she still has a TikTok, so they've got to change some things in the US Congress.
Can we just talk about the premise of like a lawmaking body passing a bill that's trying to interfere with the ownership of a private company, force the sale. What? I'm sorry, what? You can pass a law that says we are ordering the forced sale of or else? Like, what is this? Like, this is like blackmail? Like, I don't understand.
I don't know if you know this, but the invisible hand of the market actually belongs to AIPAC, and it's inside the ass of every senator. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, I should say that, but this does seem like it would be against the law. Remember when U.S. presidents were known for trust busting?
Yeah, I keep reading this headline over and over again. U.S. House passes bill forcing TikTok owner to divest the social media platform or risk losing its 150 million U.S. users. The bill becomes law. They have a six-month ultimatum to divest its controlling stake in TikTok, or else it will lose its 150 million users in the States. We, you know, everybody who's listening to this already knows that this is happening because AIPAC said so, because Jonathan Greenblatt from the ADL said we have a TikTok problem, that the new generation is not pro-Israel, and how do we get them to stay pro-Israel? Oh, we have to just control what they consume. And when they actually consume content about Palestine, then they actually become pro-Palestinian because, you know, I don't know, it's like difficult to get young people to agree to like permanent occupation and apartheid of a people and like racial elimination and genocide. They don't like that. I mean, I don't know why, but they just don't. And so if they know about it, then they don't like it. But well, we can prevent them from knowing about it if we just interfere with the media that they consume. And we know about the massive censorship on Meta, like you've said. But TikTok is a place where that doesn't exist in the same way. And a lot of people are getting their education from there, rightfully so, because they're not getting that education from the mainstream media or even from the Meta-owned social media sites.
We can strong-arm the sale of a company because that's how the free market works. Also, I just want to read this for no reason at all. Antitrust laws.
Right. Okay.
These laws prohibit anti-competitive conduct and mergers that deprive American consumers, taxpayers, and workers of the benefits of competition. The Sherman Antitrust Act. This law prohibits conspiracies that unreasonably restrain trade. Under the Sherman Act, agreements among competitors to fix prices or wages, rig bids, or allocate customers, workers, or markets are criminal violations. Other agreements, such as exclusive contracts that
It's like the...
I'm not done. You think I'm done? I'm not done.
I thought you were done.
Other agreements, such as exclusive contracts that reduce competition, may also violate the Sherman Antitrust Act and are subject to civil enforcement. The Sherman Act also makes it illegal to monopolize, conspire to monopolize, or attempt to monopolize a market for products or services. An unlawful monopoly exists when one firm has market power for a product or service, and it has obtained or maintained that market power not through competition on the merits, but because the firm has suppressed competition by engaging in anti-competitive conduct. Monopolization offenses may be prosecuted criminally or civilly. I'm about to head to Pyongyang. You know what I mean? Fuck out of here.
If I remember from my competition law class in law school, which was a very long time ago, the Sherman Act restricts the behavior of companies, right? But it's almost like the U.S. Congress is violating the Sherman Act through this bill. The Sherman Act doesn't apply to the government, right? It applies to companies.
That's the craziest thing to say, where it's like the laws that we write don't apply to us. They just apply to other companies. Like,
I want to talk about the latest ceasefire proposal by Hamas. Permanent ceasefire after a six-week prisoner exchange. All Israeli prisoners will be released upon the end of the hostilities. They are specifically saying that women, children, the elderly, and ill prisoners will be released in exchange for 700 to 1,000 Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. In contrast, Israel's proposal is that any prisoner release would only take place in the context of a temporary ceasefire, after which Israel would start bombarding Gaza again after 6 weeks, and a full-scale Israeli invasion of Rafah would take place regardless of the negotiation outcome. So basically, I hope that by now when people hear both sides' proposals, they can see how oppressive the Israeli proposal is. Like, I hope it's clear to everyone, and it's not just clear to me, but the notion that Hamas saying, we'll give you back all of the Israeli hostages in exchange for a permanent ceasefire. And Israel is saying, no, we will take the hostages, but we're going to keep bombing you after we get the hostages back. And we're going to invade Rafah in any event. How on earth could that be the position? Why would anyone in their right mind accept that?
It's what's known universally as a bad deal. Like, I don't feel as though anybody could look at that and come away thinking that the occupation is negotiating in good faith, right? If you're actually looking at it and you understand words and you can read and you see the proposals put forth by both parties, there's no way that a learned person, anybody who puts thoughts together coherently, could come away from that and be like, so confusing.
Yeah, or great deal.
Really hard to know who's making good points.
What Israel is saying is that Palestinians in Gaza cannot aspire to anything except constant Israeli attack. That's what they're saying. They're saying there is no outcome. There is no option, no alternative for you 2.3 million people, 1 million of whom are children. There is no reality where you can exist as a free people. The best you can hope for in this life is a constant state of Israeli attack with a brief pause of a period of a few weeks while we get back our hostages. But after that's over, we're back to constant uninterrupted bombardment and starvation. And that's the only reality that you people are allowed to know. They're not offering another reality. Hamas is saying, okay, we'd like to live without bombardment. We'll give you back all your hostages, but there has to be a permanent ceasefire after that. And the fact that this proposal was called by Israel outrageous, unrealistic, number of other adjectives that you know, simply do not describe what it is.
The Middle East Eye interviewed Ami Ayalon, former director of the occupation's Shin Bet agency, which is like their FBI. And he said that if he were a Palestinian living under occupation, that he would fight against the occupation in every capacity. And I just want to read his statements. Now, remind you, this is the former director of Shin Bet. Okay. And this is what he said. This is his quote. He was asked, if you were a Palestinian living in the West Bank or Gaza, what would your view be of Israel? And he said, I would fight against Israel in order to achieve my liberty. He was asked, how dirty would you fight? How dirty? And he said, I would do everything in order to achieve my liberty. And that's it. You cannot deter a person or a group of people if they believe that they have nothing to lose. I think that speaks to also what David Ben-Gurion said, right? Which is that he would rebel against the occupation. He would take up arms against the occupation. And if he were an Arab leader, he would never sign an agreement with the occupation. These are the words of the original Zionists, you know, who came to colonize, called themselves colonizers. And the words of the present day colonizers, the Zionists, who now call themselves indigenous. Very confusing. But that guy led the intelligence agency Shin Bet. And so it's a through line of people who are part of the occupation, who fully understand what it takes and what they themselves would do if they were put in the position of Palestinians.
Why are people hopeless in the context of Palestine? Because they've been ethnically cleansed for over 7 decades. Because their land and their homes have been stolen. Because they've been denied their right to return to their land and their home. Because they lack civil, political, economic rights on their land. They lack the right to self-determination, even though that is their right. But that right has been consistently denied for over 7 decades. It's this totality, this reality, that is the reason for the hopelessness. So unless you address the root causes, you're never going to have a situation where we can even begin to dream about addressing the hopelessness of Palestinians. And so let's look at the post-war Gaza proposals put forward by Hamas and Israel on the other side. Hamas says 3 points: full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, unrestricted flow of aid into Gaza, all displaced Palestinians allowed to return to their homes. Now, by the way, all three of those points are consistent with international law. Israel must withdraw from Gaza because Gaza is occupied. And not only Gaza, but the entire occupied West Bank. That is the position of international law. So Hamas here is putting forward a position which is consistent with international law. Number two, unrestricted flow of aid into Gaza. Israel has no right to control what aid or goods are coming into or going out of Gaza. This entire premise that Israel controls what is being imported and exported out of Gaza is part and parcel of Israel's illegal and permanent occupation of Gaza. In what world do we think that it is okay for a foreign entity to control what is going into or out of the land of another people? If all of a sudden Canada were to start controlling what's coming into and going out of the US, I think Americans would start to have a problem with it.
It's something that's caused a few kerfuffles in the past, actually.
There is no other comparable analogy where we are okay with a foreign entity controlling what another people eat and drink and what they have access to in terms of services and goods. It's just simply not okay for anyone else. But for some reason, when we talk about Palestine, we talk about Gaza, we're just used to this conversation of, oh, there's aid, it has to go in, it has to be checked by Israel. No, this is not okay. The only thing that is okay is freedom. Number three, Hamas has said that all displaced Palestinians must be allowed to return home. 100% the only solution that is consistent with international law. Israel has no right to ethnically cleanse Gaza of Palestinians, to force them to any other land, and to prevent them from returning to their homes. But we've already talked about it on the Palestine Pod a few episodes ago. Israel has already split up Gaza into two parts, creating a road that runs through the central part of Gaza, now effectively creating a northern Gaza and a southern Gaza. By the way, this verbiage of northern Gaza and southern Gaza, it didn't exist before October 7th. This is a reality on the ground that Israel has manufactured, that it has created. It has created a separation where there's now a northern Gaza and a southern Gaza. And those in the north can't go to those in the south. And those in the south can't go back to their homes in the north. And it has effectively split up Gaza into two smaller pieces. And this pattern of Israel fragmenting our land and confining us to smaller and smaller bits of our land and preventing us from traveling to the other bits of our land that are right next to those bits. That's what Israel has done with Palestine all along. That's what it's doing all over the occupied West Bank. That's what it did when it created Israel on top of Palestine. It's repeating the same pattern of just separating Palestinians from one another, fragmenting their land, and creating facts on the ground that make it impossible for Palestinians to have any sort of freedom of movement.
And it's also consistent with U.S. policy in the past of fragmenting areas in order to divide them, conquer them, install U.S. military bases. For instance, North and South Korea and in Sudan.
On the other side, the Israeli proposal is that there's going to be an indefinite Israeli military occupation in Gaza. All Palestinian political factions are to be banned from Palestinian government. UNRWA is to be disbanded, and aid will instead be distributed by Palestinians selected by Israel. And finally, possible establishment of Jewish-only settlements in Gaza, which is consistent with the settlement conference that we have seen in the days after the ICJ order was rendered, where a number of ministers got together and they unveiled a plan for settling in Gaza. They had a map of Gaza, and they had even every new settlement that was envisaged identified on the map with its location. For example, my family's neighborhood of Zaytun, which is one of the oldest neighborhoods in Gaza, is now, according to this map, going to be transferred into an illegal Jewish settlement called Shivat Zion. This is what they said at the settlement conference. And at the settlement conference, they also had stands for each new colony where interested settlers could sign up to be like, I'm interested in living in this settlement in Gaza. This is all from the 972 magazine article about this settlement conference. It's very creepy, creepy, creepy stuff. You could sign up and you could indicate your interest for wanting to move to that settlement once it will be built. So how could you look at both sides' proposals on this post-war reality and not realize that the Israeli proposal is a further entrenchment of its denial of Palestinian rights. It's like suffocating us more and more and more to the point where we can no longer breathe at all. And Hamas is simply saying, just lighten the grip off of our necks a little bit. It's not even saying in this proposal, we want freedom, full freedom, like all free people of the world, right? They're just saying, let us breathe a little bit. And that's what was being rejected, right, by Israel. Oh, no, no, that can't happen. That's totally outrageous. So these are the positions of the two entities. I don't know how anyone can look at this and not realize how oppressive the Israeli proposals are. And notice that all of them are inconsistent with international law. All of them are actually violations of international law, right? And Hamas is only asking for the respect of international law.
Right. And since we've been mentioning Hamas a lot on the pod, I just want to read a top United Nations official on February 14th denied that Hamas is a terrorist group. He said, "Hamas is not a terrorist group for us. It's a political movement," said Martin Griffiths, the UN's Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, who directs the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. And this actually comes on the heels of revelations that the occupation has tortured UN workers in order to get them to reveal false statements about their connection to Hamas. And so, if you guys are OGs of the Palestine pod, you know that my awakening was being tortured by a Jewish fraternity. Our hands tied behind our backs, they had us blindfolded, etc. And, you know, a lot of people, when I told that story, called me a liar. They are like, I know people and this never happened. We're going to sue you for defamation. This is what they said to me. And now you're seeing those tactics and worse being done not just to Palestinians, but to human rights UN workers as well. Like, so if they're torturing people who work for the UN in order to get them to make false statements, can you imagine what they're doing to Palestinians who are languishing in the Zionist dungeons with literally no press, with literally no coverage, with a very small group of people who are truly invested in what's happening to those people? Can you imagine how bad it is if they're openly torturing UN workers? I feel like torturing UN workers isn't even a sentence we should have to say. You know what I mean? It's getting to that place where we're starting to say sentences that just don't even make sense anymore.
Sure.
Like,
sure,
No, I promise. Hamas is actually not a terror group. The people who are torturing UN workers are terrorists. Do you take their UN vest off before you torture them? I'm so curious. Or do you torture them in uniform? I mean, I know the selfie is much juicier if they're wearing the uniform, but then you get to wear their jacket if you take it off because you're stealing people's stuff, like the Nazis did when they lived right outside of Auschwitz. I don't know if you've seen that film, but there's a film about a Nazi family who lives right outside of Auschwitz. And, you know, they go through all of the clothes, they find some of the like things that belong to other people, and then they're styling them. And it's impossible to separate those memories, those stories of Nazis rifling through Jewish women's clothing from the occupation army, who is doing literally the same thing right now, posing with women's lingerie, posting it to their social media. And it's the same thing. It's literally the same.
The analysis is, it's the same thing. Like, there's nothing else.
I'm not even gonna, there's no more analysis. It's literally the same.
It's just the same thing. Yeah.
That brings us back to when the Zionists admitted that they studied the Warsaw Ghetto, not from the perspective of the uprising, but from the perspective of the Nazis, so that they could better inflict pain on Palestinians so that they themselves, this is them speaking, could replicate the horrors of the Holocaust on Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, all over. And that's why you're seeing it happen right now. That's why we're watching the Holocaust happening on our cell phones.
So I just want to add to what you have mentioned about the reports of UNRWA employees being tortured by the Israeli occupation. Al Jazeera came out with an article on March 13th called Not Just the UNRWA Report, Countless Accounts of Israeli Torture in Gaza. In February, UNRWA published a report detailing the extensive use of torture against Palestinians taken prisoner by the Israeli military in Gaza, including 21 UNRWA staff members, 15 family members of UNRWA staff as well. Findings in that report are consistent with testimonies that Al Jazeera has been gathering from people detained in Gaza and tortured by Israel since October 7th. There have been well-documented cases in which arbitrarily detained Palestinians were subjected to deeply degrading treatment, a circumstance that's also detailed in the UNRWA report. According to the UNRWA report, UNRWA had documented the release of 1,002 detainees ranging from the age of 6 to 82 by Israel at the Karam Abu Salem crossing between December 18th and February 19th. They basically take them into Israel to torture them, and they drop them back off at the Karam Abu Salem crossing. And so between December 18th and February 19th, 1,002 detainees, 6 to 82 years old, were released at the Karam Abu Salem crossing after having been tortured. The released detainees included UNRWA staff, women, children, the elderly, and vulnerable people living with conditions like Alzheimer's and cancer, all of whom were taken from Gaza and held at various locations within Israel. To help these individuals, UNRWA set up a reception facility at the Karam Abu Salem crossing, where they provided food and water to the released persons and tried to help them reach their families. Literally, UNRWA set up a reception center. Can you imagine? Like an ad hoc reception center where every day the tortured people would get dropped off, try to like figure out where their families were and see what medical care they needed because they've just been being tortured in Israel this whole time. Most instances, the released detainees are extremely disoriented, hungry, physically exhausted, and exhibit physical signs of physical and mental trauma and are wearing dirty clothes, sometimes with visible blood stains. They are often unaware that the war is continuing and on occasion do not realize that they have returned to Gaza, and they also do not know the whereabouts or fate of their loved ones, the report stated. UNRWA noted that it has only documented part of the overall number of people being detained and mistreated by Israel in Gaza. There are many more who are taken, tortured, and released. It provided an estimate of some 4,000 people overall. Now let's get into some of the specifics. Practices recorded by UNRWA include the use of a nail gun on prisoners' knees, sexual abuse against both men and women, and the insertion of what appears to be an electrified metal stick into Palestinian prisoners' rectums. They were beating me with an extendable metal bar. There was blood on my trousers, and when they saw it, they beat me there. They used a nail gun on my knee. Those nails were kept in my knee for about 24 hours until I was transported to Naqab prison, one 26-year-old male told UNRWA of his 56 days in Israeli custody. Mohammed Abdrabbo, 62, from Jabalia, told Al Jazeera that he had been displaced to the Indonesian hospital, and during the last days of the Israeli siege on that hospital, he was told everyone should move to the south. He headed for a checkpoint that had been determined to be, quote, safe by Israeli forces, where he and another man were picked out of a group of 80 people and detained. He recounts being held in a group of more than 100 men who all endured days of beatings, hunger, and cold, adding that they were kept blindfolded, not allowed to sleep, and were forced to spend most of the day kneeling. If someone lifted the blindfold off their eyes, he would be called over by the soldiers and beaten, then strung up on the barbed wire fence, he said. Another detained man told UNRWA, they made me sit on something like a hot metal stick and it felt like fire. I have burns in the anus. The soldiers hit me with their shoes on my chest and used something like a metal stick that had a small nail on the side, he said. They asked us to drink from the toilet and made the dogs attack us, he recalled, before describing how he had seen the bodies of maybe 9 people who had been detained and killed, including one who had died after they put the electric stick up his anus. He got so sick, we saw worms coming out of his body, and then he died. Khalid al-Nabriz from the Khan Yunis refugee camp told Al Jazeera that he and several other men spent 3 days without food or water. only beatings. And when they slept, they would cover us with wet blankets in the bitter cold. Several other individuals were tortured and then released by Israel and told Al Jazeera that the soldiers tormented them by asking them the same kinds of questions, including, where are the tunnels? Where is Sinwar? Where are the captives? Do you know who was a Hamas fighter? Over and over again. Rami Abu Daqqa from Bani Suhaila in Gaza told Al Jazeera that he and his family tried to return home from Rafah in late January. So these are Palestinians trying to go back to their homes that they were displaced from. As they approached the house, Israeli snipers opened fire, shooting him in the leg, his voice breaking. He added that his brother Hani was shot and killed in the same barrage. He went on to describe how Israeli soldiers first administered aid for the gunshot wound in his leg and then beat him to get him to confess to knowing Hamas fighters. Then he was transferred to an Israeli hospital where he was blindfolded, handcuffed around the clock, and interrogated regularly. Counts of mistreatment released detainees gave Al Jazeera at the hospital where they were being treated matched those in the UNRWA report. The report went further to say that all of the released detainees needed medical attention and were transferred to hospital immediately from the border crossing wherever possible, given the dire condition of Gaza's health sector after nearly 6 months of Israeli attacks. In one case that the report detailed, urgent medical transport was arranged for a child who was released at the Karam Abu Salim crossing with dog bites visible on his body and a bruised face. That's not even the entirety of the article. I encourage everybody to go read it on Al Jazeera. It's called Not Just the UNRWA Report, Countless Accounts of Israeli Torture in Gaza. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of these reports coming out all the time. It's just one of them. Just keep that in mind also as one of the other phenomenon of this genocide, the mass torture that's taking place of thousands of Palestinians who will never be the same and who are being traumatized every second that this genocide continues.
Folks, that's been another episode of the Palestine Pod. Thank you all so much for listening. Check out our full episodes and sources at www.palestinepod.com. Follow us on Instagram at ThePalestinePod. Send us an email at PalestinePod@gmail.com. And look for us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/PalestinePod. That's been another episode of the pod. Thank you all so much for listening. Have as good a day as you can.
We can start telling people to join the Patreon. The show wouldn't be possible without a Patreon. You got to get on our Patreon. Support us on Patreon. You can, you know, because like I've been watching all these other podcasts and they just keep plugging Patreon like all the time.
Yeah, I'm gonna clip what you just did right now.
Okay.